From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a pioneer in the mapping of the human genome. Craig Venter led the team that first decoded the full genome of one person, and that person was Venter himself. He's written a new book called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. Also today, three of the people behind the sitcom Aliens in America. It's about a high school outcast whose parents take in an exchange student, hoping that student will be a companion for their son. They're thrown for a loop when the exchange student turns out to be a Pakistani Muslim, and the only thing they know about Pakistan or Islam is stereotypes about terrorists. We'll meet co-creators Moses Port and David Garacio and writer Samir Gardezi. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, J. Craig Venter, is a pioneer in the mapping of the human genome. This year, his team was the first to publish the full genome of a single individual. The full genome means it includes the chromosomes inherited from both the mother and the father. The person whose genome Venter's team mapped was Venter himself. A few years ago, Venter's privately funded team raced with a consortium led by the National Institute of Health to publish a first draft of the human genome. At a press conference led by President Clinton in 2000, they announced a tie. Now Venter claims to be close to creating artificial life in the form of a bacterium that he thinks can be used in the creation of biofuels. Earlier in his career, Venter was the first scientist to sequence the genome of a bacterium. Venter is the founder and president of the J. Craig Venter Institute. He's written a new book called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. Craig Venter, welcome to Fresh Air. Since we're going to be talking about your work, sequencing the human genome, we should explain exactly what that means, sequencing the human genome.
Well, it's actually a good question. So, because people use mapping, sequencing, all kinds of different terms interchangeably. First of all, the human genome is our complete collection of genes, all our DNA information on our chromosomes that we inherit one set of from each of our parents. So we actually have pairs of chromosomes. We have 22 pairs of, they're called autosomes, and then we have the sex chromosomes. Women have two X chromosomes, men have an X and a Y. So the process of actually sequencing the genome is determining the exact order of the four different letters, the A, C's, G's, and T's that comprise, that are used to dictate the, indicate the chemical letters of the genome. We have 6 billion of those in each of our cells, of those letters, and determine the price order on the orientation of those down our chromosomes. Actually reading the genetic code is what we do with sequencing the human genome.
And what does that tell us about who we are?
Well, it in fact shows us everything about our evolution as a species. When we sequenced the human genome, the anticipation was by many is that our genetic code would be totally unique and not resemble any other species. Those that wanted humans to be separate from all other life, I guess, were hoping for that. Some people were hoping for 300,000 genes, and a couple of biotech companies claimed they had patented 300,000 genes. It turns out our genetic code has around 23,000 genes, not all that different from any other mammal. And more importantly, while we differ from each other in the 1 to 2% range, we differ from our closest relatives, the apes, the chimpanzees, by maybe 5 or 6%. And when we look at gene sequences, the portions that actually code for proteins, we're only on the order of perhaps 1% different from chimpanzees and less than 10% different from all other mammals at that level. So it gives us hints about our evolution. We can look at what's different in our genome versus the chimp genome to maybe see how we developed a larger brains, the ability to speak as examples. But it also tells us the basis of our biology. Each one of us has a totally unique genetic code, with the exception of identical twins. But they have other unique manifestations in terms of no two people have the same fingerprints, even identical twins, because of random changes as we go from one cell to 100 trillion cells.
What kind of genetic database would you eventually like to have, and how would you like to use it?
Well, our goal is over this next decade to see if we can get as many as 10,000 human genomes. And just having the genetic information on its own is not very useful. What we need along with it is all the phenotypic information, health outcomes, psychology tests, etc., so that we can begin to solve what this data allows us to solve, that is, what's truly nature, what's truly nurture, and the wide variety of traits and diseases. I think we can answer some of those questions in a pretty definitive fashion. But the interesting things is it may be slightly different and will be slightly different for all of us, depending on which genes changes and gene sets we have. But I think we have a chance in the near future to answer most of these questions that are pretty commonly asked throughout humanity.
We mentioned the question of nature or nurture. What are some of the other questions that you feel like you could ask with this genetic database?
Well, it's very key as we go forward with the constant double-digit inflation in healthcare costs in this country to see if we can go much more into a preventative medicine paradigm. If we know which diseases we're at risk for, we can, in most cases, start to do something about them, either in terms of early diagnosis, actually changing lifestyle, as I discussed for heart disease, and early treatment. Most cancers are not directly genetic. Only a tiny fraction are caused by changes that we inherit from our parents in the genetic code. Most of them are from changes we collect in our bodies over our lifetimes from x-rays, from environmental toxins, etc. But if you know that you have an increased risk genetically for, say, colon cancer, the statistics are pretty overwhelming in terms of if you can detect that cancer before symptoms appear. Colon cancer detected early is very treatable. It's not very expensive to treat with surgery. And the longevity outcomes are quite encouraging. Over 90% live longer than 10 years after a diagnosis. So I view genomic information as providing power and control to individuals over our own lives versus just waiting for happenstance and symptoms to appear.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Craig Venter. He's a pioneer of genetics. And in his private research, he tied with the Human Genome Project in mapping the human genome, and it's work he's continued to do. He has a new book now, which is called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. Now, you began your genome research at the National Institute of Health, but you left the NIH to form your own company, a nonprofit company. Why did you want to leave the NIH to pursue genome research independently?
Well, I think most scientists have the dream that they would love to have their own research institute. And it was an institute, not a company. And I was given the opportunity to have my own independent research institute that was, in fact, funded by a group of venture capitalists that were hoping the results that my institute produced would flow into a company that they started to find faster cures for diseases. But the primary reason, in fact, I envisioned staying at the NIH for a long time when I was there. The intramural program was probably the best place to do research in the country because we had large budgets. We didn't have to write grants, and we had a lot of independent direction, which is how I was able to make early breakthroughs there. But I was also very limited in terms of trying to expand the research. I got very excited about the notion of sequencing the human genome, and it became very clear that was not going to happen at the NIH, certainly not within the NIH. And so having the opportunity for my own independent research organization, I jumped at that chance.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are now about the role of private companies and pharmaceutical companies in this brand new research. I mean, we're facing the possibility of pharmaceutical companies patenting. I'm not really sure what we're facing, but can private companies patent genes or patent variations on genes? Or are we risking that things that are an essential part of human nature will be privately owned by pharmaceutical companies?
Well, it's a good and it's an important question, and one that reflects a lot of the bias and misunderstanding that's out there. I mean, yes, human genes can be patented like genes from any species. In fact, life forms can be patented, as ruled several decades ago by the Supreme Court. The number one organization for patenting human genes is actually the U.S. government through the National Institutes of Health. There's very few genes that have made their way directly into therapeutics, but some of those are extremely important. The first and perhaps the most important one for any of your listeners that have insulin-dependent diabetes was the original cloning and then the expression of the human insulin gene and turning it into a pharmaceutical product by Genentech and Eli Lilly. The only way they were able to do that was by having a patent which allowed them not ownership of the insulin gene. They don't own mine. They don't own yours. What they have is a legal right for a limited period of time to commercially produce that human insulin. The treatment for diabetes used to be dependent totally on having pig insulin, which people develop resistance to and antibodies to. And so the human insulin has been a lifesaver for tens of millions of people. So that's one of the fallacies about patents. Patents are not ownership. They're a brief, limited right that the government gives in exchange for public disclosure of all the information about the invention so other people can build on it to commercially produce what's in that patent. I think if there were not patents on drugs and medicines, we would not have a pharmaceutical industry. We would not have a biotech industry. The government does not produce drugs. In most cases, it has not discovered anything that would end up as a pharmaceutical. So it's an important part of the exchange we make as a society with the inventors, the companies, the institutions that make these breakthroughs so that, in fact, they will find their way into commercial development. If there's no commercial development, we don't have access to them as patients.
My guest is J. Craig Venter, a pioneer in the mapping of the human genome. His new book is called A Life Decoded. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Craig Venter, a pioneer of human genome research, and his new book is called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. And his company tied with the Human Genome Project in mapping the human genome. He continues to do genomic research. Clearly, you are so excited at the prospect of what we can learn from sequencing the human genome. And you're working now on new forms of bacteria that can contribute to the production of alternate fuels. What are some of your concerns about these new doors that we're opening and how they might be misused?
Well, I'm concerned about two things. I'm certainly concerned about the public understanding of science, and I view it's every scientist's responsibility to speak out about what they're doing to help the broader public understand what is being done and why it's being done. And that doesn't get done frequently enough. We've just finished a study and we'll be releasing it soon in conjunction with MIT. It's been funded by the Sloan Foundation to actually look at these risks and to look at laboratory practices for this new emerging field of synthetic biology, which is has some wonderful potential for making new biofuels, new vaccines, new ways of doing chemical synthesis, maybe eliminating the petrochemical industry in the future. That give us a tremendous hope. But I think there's a large number of technologies that do have that potential for abuse that we need to guard against. On the same hand, let me add that, you know, probably the biggest threat facing us are new emerging infections. Your listeners have certainly heard of SARS most recently, but HIV, both which have emerged in recent history. As our population goes from 6 billion to 9 billion people over the next 40 or so years, if that prediction is met, we're definitely going to have new emerging infections. Some have predicted new pandemics from flu, but we definitely have to develop new weapons against new emerging infections that could affect tens to hundreds of millions of people on this planet. And that's something that we're falling way behind as a country. Government funding and pharmaceutical company funding has all drifted away from new vaccines, new antivirals, and new antibiotics.
Do you see your research as being connected to medical research now and trying to alter genes, like to find the gene for breast cancer in the hopes that maybe that gene can be changed?
Well, I think the notion of gene therapy was one of the early naive assumptions out of the genetic code.
Naive
in the sense that, you know, like a broken carburetor, we could just go in and repair it. We have 100 trillion cells in our bodies, and the only way that you can repair genes is to change the genetic code for future generations. With rare exceptions, gene therapy just will not work. But understanding risk genes, and I think we're now up to at least a half a dozen associated with breast cancer, and I'm sure another dozen or two will be found as we examine the genetic code more thoroughly, that these are important information that can really help, in the case of breast cancer, women in a preventative medicine paradigm. It's also an example of how inadequate understanding of genetics has led to probably more aggressive changes than probably were warranted. I think many physicians not understanding what the, quote, breast cancer gene was really telling them were telling women that they had a 90% chance or better of having breast cancer when it's nowhere near that. There are only tiny percentages for the general population other than the very small number of women that have a very strong family genetic history of breast cancer. So I think we have to understand the entire human genome. We can't just look at one gene. There is no such thing as a breast cancer gene any longer. And as we understand the beauty and complexity of our genetic code, I think it will take us in a positive direction.
You've sequenced your own genome. When do you think the rest of us would be able to get our genomes sequenced? Like, how far down the line do you think that is?
No, it's a great question. And so we just published, my genetic code is the first diploid genome that truly represents what an individual human genome looks like, because it has both sets of chromosomes contributed by my parents. The cost of sequencing genomes is changing exponentially, from a multi-billion dollar federal program down to $100 million at Celera to sequencing company that just claims to have sequenced Jim Watson's genome, and we're waiting for the scientific publication on that, but they claim it cost only a few million dollars. There's new technology coming out of several companies now that we think could lower the cost right now to maybe $300,000. So you can see it's changing very rapidly. So I expect within 2 to 5 years, It will be cost effective for us to do the 10,000 human genomes to try and understand this next level of interpreting our genetic code. Certainly within a decade, I'm part of the XPRIZE Foundation, where there's now a $10 million prize for the scientist that developed the technology to get us to very rapid, cost-effective sequencing of human genomes so that it will be available to wide aspects of the world's population as we go forward. There's certainly opportunities with several groups now over the next year or two. I'm hoping it will become a major part of preventative medicine and healthcare for all individuals in this country within a decade.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I enjoyed your questions and your discussion. So thank you for having me.
J. Craig Venter's new book is called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Giant's House, A Story of the Unlikeliest of Loves by Elizabeth McCracken, and from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Aliens in America, the new sitcom about a high school nerd whose only friend is the exchange student living in his home. That student is a Pakistani Muslim, and initially, everyone thinks he's a terrorist, or at the very least, weird. We'll meet the show's creators, David Garacio and Moses Port, and writer Samir Gardezi. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new series, Aliens in America, is a high school geek story with a twist. Justin Tolchik's parents want to find him a friend. So at the suggestion of his guidance counselor, they take in an exchange student who they are told is coming from England. They're expecting a blonde hunk, like the student pictured in the brochure. But it's not what they find when they go to the airport to pick him up and bring him back to their small town in Wisconsin.
Are you the Tolchiks? I am Raja, your exchange student.
Gear?
I'm sorry, son, there might be some confusion. The boy we ordered was supposed to come in from London.
That is me. I started in Pakistan and then I flew in from London.
Oh.
You are such good people to open your home to me. And I thank and praise Allah for bringing you into my life. Thank you, Allah, for the Tolchoks.
The Tolchoks and everyone they know have no frame of reference for Raja except stereotypes of Muslims. My guest David Garacio and Moses Port created the show and write for it. It's on the CW network Mondays. Also with us is writer Samira Gardezi, who grew up in Southern California and is of Pakistani descent. Of course, none of them can write now because of the strike by the Writers Guild. We recorded this before the strike. Moses Port, David Garacio, Samira Assad Gardezi, welcome all of you to Fresh Air. What inspired the idea for this series of a Pakistani exchange student who comes to this small town in Wisconsin and moves in with a family who's had absolutely no exposure to probably anybody from another culture?
I think it began, Moses and I were just trying to think of an idea for a new TV show. It's sort of what we get paid to do. And we were sharing our own sort of nightmarish high school experiences with each other, all these embarrassing stories, and wondering if there is a fresh take on a high school show about teenage life, a fresh, honest take that could be, because it's sort of one of those areas that you see tried quite a bit in TV and in film. And I think at the same time, we were talking a lot about what was going on in the world, in American culture, geopolitically, the war in Iraq, and I think sort of it was in that stew where we sort of came up with the idea of this Muslim character, this Pakistani Muslim character coming to this small town.
And what are some of the things that you figured that a kid who's considered a real geek in high school would have in common with the Pakistani exchange student?
I think we liked the idea that he felt like an outsider. He felt disconnected and alone, and he's on a drive to try and somehow find his way to fit in. And on the outside, at least, the exchange student embodies all those things. But I think what's nice about their dynamic and relationship is that the character of Raja is so, he's so self-actualized, he's so spiritual, and he has such a sense of himself that he is really a lifeline to the student, Justin.
Really, at the heart of it, that's what the show is about. It's about feeling alienated from wherever you are coming from. It's just something that seems to be an aspect of life in these United States these days, is that people often feel, and maybe people feel this at every time in history and in every culture, but it's very easy to feel disconnected from your world regardless of what your background is. And somehow in acknowledging that feeling of isolation and alienation, perhaps some you can actually bridge the gap between you and other people.
Now, Samir, you are of Pakistani descent, like one of the main characters in the story. At what point did you enter the picture in the creation of Aliens in America?
Well, actually, I was in the mix later on, but I was hunting down the script way before. The fact that, you know, such a subject, this topic, interested me so much, and I felt that I could be a big part of it. And I joined the staff in mid-June.
What do you think you told them that convinced them to hire you?
Call it a great insurance package. I kind of told them that, you know, not only am I familiar with the Pakistani culture, but also the Pakistani American culture, and you know that is an intersection that exists between Justin and Raja, in the sense that, you know, you have these two teenagers, and you know, even though they come from two different parts of the world, you know, they are dealing with high school problems, which are paramount and I think exist in all different types of cultures and different countries.
Samir, do you identify with either of the two characters on the show?
Yeah, completely. I think that as David and Moses were saying, you know, just those little things that happen in high school, if you're not exactly part of the popular group, those things were very evident to me, and not that far removed from my life too. I still happen to be a nerd and not a brilliant television producer like David and Moses, so I can't laugh at everyone yet. And also, you know, I think that almost verbatim in the pilot, I've dealt with similar situations that Raja did. For instance, you know, in the classroom, you know, getting questions and this odd manner as to, you know, I was specifically connected with the terrorist attacks, even though I had nothing to do with it. And, you know, the simple religious conflicts that exist too, having to pray five times a day, how does that interfere with someone else's life, you know, how do other people perceive it? So all those things in combination, I think, that are very true to that point.
Well, let me play the scene that you just referred to, in which this is, I think, probably like your first day in class, and the teacher's kind of trying to discuss difference with the students and goes about it in an absolutely horrible way. So here's the scene from Aliens in America.
Class, today I'm going to put aside our lesson because we have a special guest. For 1 year, we will be in the presence of a real live Pakistani who practices Muslimism. That means we have the opportunity to learn about his culture and he about ours. So let's begin a dialogue. Raja, you are so different from us. How does that feel?
I am not sure I understand.
Mm-hmm. Think about it. How does everyone else feel about Raja and his differences? Yes, Stephanie.
Well, I guess I feel angry because his people blew up the buildings in New York.
Oh, that's good.
But that is not true.
Okay, Raja, in America, you have to wait until you're called on, and I'd appreciate a raised hand.
That's a scene from Aliens in America, and my guests are the two creators and executive producers of the show, Moses Port and David Garacio, and Samir Assad Gardezi, who's one of the staff writers. So, Samir, when you were in high school and people assumed that you were somehow, I think this is what you're saying, connected to to the world of terrorism. Did people also think that you practiced Muslimism? Is that, like, who came up with that on the show?
That was something Moses and I inserted in the script, and that whole scene from the pilot was just this kind of thing. Once we wrote it, we knew if they don't want to shoot it exactly the way we just wrote it, we don't want to do the show. And there's like a few times as a TV writer producer, you can feel like you've written something you can absolutely stand behind and insist that it's done that way. But that scene was one of those.
My guests are Moses Port and David Garacio, the co-creators of Aliens in America, and Samir Gardezi, one of the writers. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Moses Port and David Garacio, the co-creators of Aliens in America, about a high school nerd, Justin Tulchuk, and the Pakistani exchange student Raja living with the Tulchuk family. Also with us is Samir Gardezi, one of the show's writers. Gardezi is the youngest of the three. He's of Pakistani descent. My guess is that before September 11th, most of the students in your high school didn't know anything about Pakistan and wouldn't even know which ways to stereotype you if they wanted to. You know what I mean? Like, they probably had, like, no idea what Pakistan was.
Yeah, I think that I naturally got lumped into this often-found conflation where India is the same thing as Iraq, and Iraq is the same thing as Morocco. So there was this uneasy conflation that happened. So I think that, you know, I would get the stereotype of Apu from The Simpsons all the way from, you know, Aladdin. So it was disparate stereotypes.
Those were the days when we could just group wholesale prejudices into one group. Wow.
One group of cartoon characters.
Yes.
Yeah. We were kids at that time.
Right, of course, yes. What I'd like to do is, like, go around the room and ask each of you to tell a story from your high school years that figured in some way or another into the script for Aliens in America?
Well, one thing that I know that, I mean, I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, and I was one of three Jewish kids in a class of 900. And I do remember being in music class and being in around holiday time, and we'd all sing Christmas carols. And then the teacher would say, okay, now we're going to sing a Hanukkah song, and they would have the three Jewish kids stand up and sing it in isolation, as if they weren't meaning to be discriminatory, but it was obviously so awkward. And there's that feeling that made me that's part of the outsiderness that we were trying to imbue in the script.
Moses, I had no idea you were Jewish. Just kidding. David, how about a story from your life?
For me, I think probably what maybe comes through in the show the most is I grew up in New York on Long Island, and I moved in the middle of my junior year to a small town in Michigan. And I just went from being a very sort of comfortable, secure place in sort of the community that I grew up in. And I mean, to my mind, I might as well have been moving to Pakistan, because Michigan seemed so different to me from what I was used to in New York. It was just sort of a less, in truth, it was sort of a less cosmopolitan sort of atmosphere, even in high school. And I went from sort of really fitting in from one place to not fitting in at all in the other place. And every day at lunch was sort of a challenge as to how to handle my time, because I didn't have anyone to sort of eat with for that second semester of my junior year. So I'd find corners throughout the school to feed myself and hopefully seem inconspicuous and not look like the kid who absolutely doesn't have any friends.
To be fair, I've eaten lunch with him, and it's better that he does it alone.
Samir, how about a story from your life that figured in one way or another into a storyline for Aliens in America?
I don't have that exact fish out of water experience as much as I make fun of my high school upbringing. It was a very diverse campus. It was in Anaheim. It was called Esperanza High School. And I'd say a very memorable experience. And I mean, it happens yearly. It's just whenever I have to fast Ramadan, and it's during those lunch periods where I really have to figure out what I'm supposed to do with my time. And, you know, kids can be cruel. I remember the main thing was, you know, trying to see whether people can get me to eat. And it'd always be kind of so painstaking just sitting there with your friends and trying to socialize while they're chowing down, and then always the same question: hey Samir, you know, why aren't you eating? Or, you know, hey Samir, you know, you want some of this? Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Mine turned out not to be as funny as your guys's.
Well, in fairness to your high school friends, I feel like in the writer's room we've sort of taunted you with popsicles and pistachio nuts while you were fasting as well, so we really haven't grown up at all is sort of what we're learning from this.
Since we were talking about high school experiences that became the basis of storylines in Aliens in America, I thought I'd bring up a couple of the storylines and see if any of you have a personal connection with these. Let's start with the mother intervening in totally inappropriate, embarrassing ways when you are singled out for derision in high school. You know, like people are mocking you, so the mother comes in to complain to the guidance counselor. Does that happen to any of you?
Moses.
My mom will be listening to this. I know my mother was quick to show up at school, but I'm not sure it was always, sometimes it wasn't even in defense of us. It was just out of interest and being connected to what was going on in our lives.
A little embarrassing though, huh?
I think what also that partly comes from is I have two kids. Moses has three kids, and we're very aware of our own impulse to keep the strings attached as much as we possibly can. I have two daughters, 10 and 7, and although they're not as old as Justin is, I already feel, whenever I sort of feel them growing up and sort of moving on their own, my impulse is to get closer, which is not always the healthiest thing. And I think so in addition to sort of mining our own beloved mother's maternal influence, we're also sort of acknowledging some of our own impulses.
Right. Yeah. As a parent, when you see your kid suffer, I mean, there's nothing more painful, but obviously you want to act. You're desperate to act. And Justin is a kid who struggles quite a bit. So Franny may be overbearing, but it's coming from a place. There's a lot of ammunition as to why she's overbearing.
There's one episode in which there's a club called Rocket Science that doesn't really exist, but Justin has made it up with some friends for various reasons. It's just a way to kind of get away. And Raja ends up covering for him and acting like it really exists in order to save Justin. Anyone want to claim that one of telling a lie in order to protect a friend?
I think Raja's doing that not to protect his friend. He was pulled into the lie, and he has trouble. He's at odds with maintaining a lie, and it's own for his own self-preservation. He feels that if he could turn it into something truthful, then the club could actually build a rocket instead of just wasting time and using it as a ruse to fool Justin's parents, then he wouldn't be doing something wrong. So it's actually for a little more selfish reasons that Raja does it.
You know, I will say what's probably difficult about that one is I think Raja is so unique in the construction of the character that he's actually acting in a way that most high school kids wouldn't. Most high school kids sort of lie fairly comfortably, and he's a character who just doesn't. And that was just a real important aspect of the show when we, Moses and I, were developing and creating it, that Raja have this sort of moral center in a family where no one else really did. And of course, in that episode, it backfires on him quite a bit.
Have you gotten any complaints either within the CW network or from viewers being either called racist or anti-American or something? Somebody from like any position kind of throwing stones at you because of the depictions of either Raja or the
Americans
in the
show.
Yeah.
So far, the response we've had, we'll start with sort of the Muslim community, has been overwhelmingly positive. You know, we did a screening here at the Islamic Center of Southern California, where the show had a real nice reception. We also had the opportunity to have the show screened at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C.
That's where all the sitcoms start.
Right. Which was
let's have a screening at the Brookings Institution, yeah.
Yes, it was sort of an unexpected opportunity, but it was just really exciting to have a lot of people from the Muslim community in D.C. and State Department types come out to sort of see the show and talk about, you know, bridging. They're doing a whole series on sort of trying to bridge the gap between Muslim culture and American culture. And the one interesting thing was there have been some people who sort of expressed some concern about how we're depicting small town Americans. And actually at Brookings, a woman came up afterwards to talk to me and Moses and said, "I really like your show, but I have a problem with the way you're depicting cheerleaders." And I just think I used to be a cheerleader, and I just take it personally, we're a lot smarter and more interesting, and we're not sluts. And we said, the cheerleader in the episode she was talking about didn't do anything that could possibly even seem promiscuous. So we just said, well, maybe you're projecting a little bit because we're not quite doing anything like that. So
the spirited cheerleader lobby is out there and
yes.
Vocal.
Don't worry, they're in D.C. and they're out there protecting you.
I think the most negative feedback we've gotten was our portrayal of Americans as being small minded, and
probably particularly of like small town Americans being particularly
yes.
small
yeah.
small minded.
That's been that
would be the criticism, right?
And then I would say it was interesting enough when we were at the mosque in Los Angeles, people. Certainly, they loved it. What they did raise their question was, does Raja, is he too perfect? Which we brought up before, which was, you know, and we ran through the gamut of reasons of why he is the way he is. And we hope to further humanize him with flaws of the human condition as we go forward. But you're definitely under a microscope, much more so than any other show that we've worked on.
Well, here's another scene from Aliens in America. Justin and Raja are in their English class, where none of the students have read the assigned book, Robinson Crusoe. So the teacher tries a different approach.
All right, let's think about this in a whole new way. You have a chance to start civilization over again. What would you bring with you on a desert island? Yes?
A machine that makes everything?
Anyone else?
Robinson Crusoe by Willem Dafoe?
It's Daniel Dafoe. Come on, people, let's think. You can only bring one item. What would it be and why? What is the one thing you can't live without? Raja from Pakistan?
If I could only bring one thing with me to a desert island, it would be Justin Tolchak.
Did he just say...
He is my best friend, and his friendship is the one thing that I cannot live without.
Homosexual!
We'll talk more with the creators of Aliens in America, Moses Port and David Garacio, and writer Samir Gardezi after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Moses Port and David Garacio, the co-creators of the CW sitcom Aliens in America, and Samira Gardezi, one of the writers. Moses Port and David Garacio, you've been working together for years. You worked together on Mad About You and then on Just Shoot Me, and now you created Aliens in America together. How did you first team up?
We met in college at the University of Pennsylvania and had a radio show together, actually, on WQHS, Penn's radio station, that you could only hear through the... If you had to live in the dorms and have a university phone line, essentially.
Oh, it's nice to have a big audience.
Yes, believe me. We had a show that ran from midnight to 2 a.m. on Sunday, and it was really just mostly existentialist radio theater because we tried to get people to call in just to sort of confirm that anyone was hearing what we were saying. And in a season's worth of shows, we got one phone call. So
we had one woman call in, and then we found ourselves desperately trying to get her to call back in. we were stalking our fan. It was very bizarre.
For her. Or your fan base, as the Concords would say. Yes.
Yes.
So, but in some ways, it's probably really good to start with nobody listening, because you can try all kinds of things without anybody throwing you off the air, because it doesn't really matter.
That was really the beauty of it. We had, like any college radio station, there was... We had sort of a list of songs and a certain amount of airplay and a format we were supposed to follow, and we just didn't follow any of it because even the people who ran the radio station were not listening to what we were doing. But for us, it was just a lot of fun, and we liked sort of creating and sort of essentially making each other laugh. So when we both moved out to Los Angeles, sort of independent of each other, we decided to sort of give it a run at writing for TV and movies.
I will say, I remember we did not show up one night for our show on the radio, and nobody commented on it. Not even our bosses at the radio. So it was a really small audience.
So it was just 2 hours of dead air.
Yeah, it might have been, yes.
So
it was.
When you first, was Mad About You the first time you actually were working on a TV show?
The first show we really worked on was a first-run syndicated teen comedy called Out of the Blue, about six teenagers who lived and worked at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. And so it was broadcast, on Saturday mornings on different stations all around the country. And
wait, was this in the Saved by the Bell era?
Exactly. It strived to be as good as Saved by the Bell.
Not nearly as highbrow as Saved by the Bell.
It was, I could say with great confidence that we worked on the worst show in television history. And that's, that's no small feat, because as we know, television is, when you're working in lowbrow, it's easy to get to the bottom. And this show was ridiculously awful. And we shot it on location at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. But Moses and I were the only writers on the staff. So we cranked out script after script with sort of very unprofessional actors and a very low production budget. But we sort of really learned how to work together during that time period. And for a first job, it was actually sort of a lot of fun. And then we got our job at Mad About You.
And that was all actually the first killer whale to be in television. So that's another first. They've been pioneers since the beginning.
It was supposed to be shot in Spanish and in English. It was an all Latino cast. And then they realized they did not have enough money to do that, so they shot it all in English, but not all of the actors spoke English well. So one of them was a tour guide, and he almost spoke no English, and we were basically writing his lines phonetically.
This is like a great career trajectory, going from a late night radio show broadcast only in the dorm that nobody listened to writing for what you describe as the worst TV show in history. No place to go but up after that.
Exactly. I like Samir's take. Yes, we brought Shamu, the killer whale, the first killer whale, to television. Now we're doing it with first Muslim character comedy.
People need to know.
So what keeps you together as writing partners?
Just afraid to do it alone. Absolutely terrified. No, Moses and I were very close friends before we started writing together. So I think for us, it's just sort of the most fun way to go about working.
It is like another marriage. I remember...
Here he goes.
David has referred to me as another wife. So, but it's a relationship, and there's definitely, when you write together, we write everything. We speak out every line. We're sitting there, we share a computer, we're working off it, and we're talking out the entire script. So we hash it out, and but ultimately at the end of the day, it's fun. We make each other laugh, and we enjoy the process.
I'm also divorced now, so now you're my only wife. So.
Well, good luck with Aliens in America, and thank you all. Moses Port, David Garacio, and Samira Sadgardezi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moses Port and David Garacio co-created the sitcom Aliens in America. Samira Gardezi writes for the show. It airs Mondays on the CW Network. We recorded the interview before the Writers Guild strike. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we call Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid to talk about the state of emergency declared by President Musharraf. Rashid says never before in Pakistan's sad history of military rule has a general so reviled invoked martial law to ensure his own survival. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.